Hello and welcome to the Comics Podcast 9/11 20th Anniversary Spectacular.
Oh dear.
By which I mostly mean episode 269. But
nice.
I am Chad and I are indulging in some drinks on this episode to celebrate the occasion. Well, not to celebrate. All this is a joke. Just go with it. I'm not, you know. But anyway, I'm Jean-Luc, I'm your host.
I want to give you a bigger shovel to dig this grave.
I said Chad is here. I'll do the 9/11 thing in a bit. Chad is here. Chad, say hello.
Hey, everybody.
Emily's also here.
Hello.
Alex decided he really did not want to bear witness to this, so he is not here. That's not the actual reason, but he's out this week. He'll be back next week.
My favorite witnesses are bears.
But Chad, you and I are... having some double Manhattans for this very special occasion.
Yeah, this was your joke, and I was like, well, I've never had a Manhattan, and I'm vaguely an alcoholic, so any excuse to drink
and you
on
know,
this show.
Understandable. And you know what? I've never had a Manhattan before either. I don't really drink this kind of stuff. I don't drink on the show very often, but I'm going to go ahead and... You've already had one. You made one the other day.
Yeah, I was excited, and I was like, I have to try this. I got all the stuff. Yeah. I think they're pretty good. They're probably not going to be like a staple, but I will slowly consume them to use up the ingredients I purchased, the vermouth and the bitters. So
I thought you'd go ahead and try it.
Chad, I thought you were going to steal vermouth and bitters from your parents.
I technically stole bitters from the parents. They didn't have any vermouth. I had to go buy that.
Hey, John.
That is fucking strong.
Yeah, it's all booze.
That's all booze. It's three different kinds of booze.
Oh, fuck. It's got a nice aftertaste, like a little. It's a sweet, like almost like syrupy aftertaste.
That's the botanicals.
Oh my god! When that hits, though, that is fucking foul. Ugh. And just so that the listeners can have the full immersive experience, I am drinking this out of my Star Wars: The Empire Strikes Back cup that I've had,
and it is striking
since I was a young boy. Oh my god.
This drink will make you into a man, Jean-Luc.
Wow, that is intense. How do people drink this shit?
I honestly think it's kind of good. It waters down good whiskey.
Oof.
It's just sweet. Like, I'm drinking Wild Turkey with mine, and it just tastes like slightly sweetened Wild Turkey with, like, herbs. It's very interesting. It's pleasant. I like it.
I don't really taste the herbs, to be honest.
I think that we might have different types of bitters, because I think that's where that comes from. There's a lot of different flavoring there depending on what you want.
The bitters and the sweet vermouth both have botanicals in them.
Interesting. Well, I'm glad I drank 2/3 of a Mountain Dew Rise before we started recording, so I have something to wash this down with when I'm done with it. I feel like if it were slightly less strong, this would be really good. I would really like this.
Well, you made double, right?
I did make a double, yeah.
I feel like a single would maybe be more your speed.
Yeah, maybe.
Well, the ratios are the same, so technically it should taste the same.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, maybe. Yeah.
Chemistry.
But I did make a double, so I don't, this is going to take me a minute to finish, guys. Ugh. That was a lot to take
in. And that's interesting because Jameson has less flavor than, like, bourbon and rye.
Yeah. And so, I got to say, I wonder if it's the vermouth, maybe, or something different, but it's really strong. It tastes really strong. I mean, usually when I drink
hard
liquor...
You're not used to drinking straight alcohol, though.
No, usually it's, like, very watered down with, like, some kind... Like, when I've had whiskey before, and I, like, enjoy whiskey drinks, like, mixed drinks, they're very watered down with, like, iced coffee or some kind of, like berry soda or something like that. Or not berry soda, but like ginger ale, I guess.
Yeah, whereas my refined ass is just like, no, I don't need ice anymore. Just pour it in a glass and I will just throw it in my face and I'll be happy.
Yeah. Well, that's fair enough. Anyway.
Happy 9/11 to all who celebrate.
Some of you may find this in poor taste. And to a degree,
yeah, we decided not to play Jenga just in case.
Yeah, exactly. We decided to keep that off the itinerary. But I will say, as somebody who, you know, doesn't remember 9/11, it is, you know, a sort of unfathomable thing to think about and to process. And so I think, you know, in a way, the mockery is kind of one of the only ways to make it feel kind of normal, you know.
Do you not remember 9/11? Because I vividly.
I was very young. I don't remember it.
You were very young and also not in the United States.
No, I was in the U.S. when it happened.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. I moved. It happened when I was 3 and we moved to Kuwait when I was 6.
Okay. I guess I thought you were younger when you guys moved to Kuwait.
No. So, but yeah, I have no recollection of it.
I don't remember anything from when I was 3 either.
Yeah. I mean, it is really, I'm not going to dwell on it too much. I don't want to, we have more important things to talk about, like comic books, but it is just a truly, you know, horrific event, and made even more horrific by, you know, the fact that it was, you know, conducted by our own intelligence services and the administration at the time, the Bush administration. But that's the lengths that those fucking sickos will go to make a profit. So
I remember when I was in elementary school when 9/11 happened, and then like in the several years like after, there was only one girl in my class who was like anti the war on terror because like she had fucking not awful parents. Oh, what a wild, what a wild time.
I was in 7th grade, and I remember when getting into history class, and they had the TV on. I was like, oh, I guess we're doing TV today. And they were playing the news. And I didn't understand it, because I was like, are we watching a movie? Because normally when the TV comes out, we put in a movie. Like, I literally did not know it was real, because the idea of like someone purposely flying planes into buildings... I couldn't grasp it. Like, I was like, this has to be a movie or something. Like, I was in 7th grade. What the fuck did I know? I don't remember literally anything else from that day. Like, that's like the one vivid memory is when I like saw the footage on the TV. It was like horrifically confused for like 15 minutes before I was like, I think something about this might not be what I think it is. Wasn't exactly smart in 7th grade.
No, who is though? But we've got some other shit to get to on this episode of the Comics Podcast.
John, I listened to one of the songs from that, I don't know how to pronounce the name of this
Lingua
artist.
Lingua Ignota.
Yeah, I listened to the, what was it, like Hands Down or something?
Many Hands.
Many Hands. The one that Chad posted Many Hands, earlier. Yes. I listened to it because Chad linked it, and not for me. You know, I gave it a shot. I sent it to my wife to see if they might enjoy it, but not for me.
Did what's your wife's take on it?
They haven't listened to it yet. I sent it to them. And they're gonna listen to it later.
I'm a little surprised they didn't already, you know.
I was too. I mentioned the name and they were not familiar. So
that's a little bit surprising, given that we, you know, tend to have similar tastes,
similar musical circles.
Yep.
But yeah,
I will say the people in the Discord I'm in for vocals and music and stuff, a lot of people there love this artist.
Yeah.
And we're very happy about this album.
I can see that from like a vocals perspective for sure, because there's definitely some vocals on this album.
She is just a phenomenal vocalist in terms of just, I don't know, injecting, like, every song is just injected with so much, like, what feels like raw emotion. And it just, you know, it just hits you. It's hard to listen to a lot of the time, right? Like, it's you know, Lingua Ignota, for those of you who don't know, her name is Kristen Hayter. She's, I think she does basically everything on her own. But she's a vocalist.
She did the music videos, apparently.
Yeah, she made the she did the music video for Pennsylvania Furnace, like, solo by herself, which is very cool and sounds very hard. But she's like a noise rock. I don't know if noise, but definitely like an experimental noise artist. But like classically trained vocalist with like some sort of metal and sort of some experimental influences as well. Yeah, and the new album, okay, it's a couple weeks old at this point, so now get ready. But I wanted to talk about it, so Chad, you know, obliged me and listened to it. Emily, I appreciate you checking out that song. I can't say I'm super shocked that both of you sort of bounced off of it. I find it just, I find myself just really taken with it. I loved her last record too, Caligula. But this, I especially find myself just really taken by sort of how raw it is and how emotional a lot of the songs are. And just how, like, I don't know, discordant so much of the instrumentation is. I mean, Many Hands in particular is just, like, kind of a terrifying song in some ways. Just the vibes are fucking awful. Just, you know, lots of, just, you know, feels like it came out of, like, you know, a horror movie or something like that.
It sounds like she's casting a spell. Like, yeah. If I were to listen to a witch cast horrible curses on people for 45, 50 minutes, like, it would be this kind of music. It's got such a weird vibe to it, because there's, like, folk elements in here, too. It's like, there's the noise stuff underneath, and then there's, like, folk instrumentation, and then she's singing just, like, she sounds really angry and upset, like, the whole way through. It's got a very thick atmosphere about it that I would not call pleasant. It's interesting. It's executed really well. It's a neat art project. It's not something I'll probably ever listen to again.
Yeah.
But it is a neat experience.
I mean, I like listening to it. Like, I think it's, like, enjoyable is maybe the wrong word, but I enjoy the experience of listening to it. Just to piggyback off that, the folk point, like, obviously very folk inspired, but almost all the lyrics are also taken from like American evangelical and American Christian folk tales that were passed down largely in her home state of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania Furnace, which is one of the other songs of the album, I think is fantastic. The whole lyric, the me and the dog, we die together. I watch you in the house where you live with your family. Do you want to go to hell with me? Is like apparently like directly taken from an old like Christian folk tale from that area. I don't know. I find that element of it really cool. Just like the way that she has taken a lot of that classic like literature and especially from, you know, from American Christianity, which is obviously very distinct from other iterations of Christianity. And just sort of refracted it through a modern lens and a lens that feels very personal to her. Because, like, a lot of these songs are very it's very clear that at one point they were, like, religious stories, right? But sort of taking those and making them about, you know, other things that are more, like, about her, you know, more personal experiences. I don't know. I really dig the whole thing. I find it incredibly cool and have been really enjoying listening to it over the last few weeks.
It reminds me of when Black Dress's Waste Isolation came out. We listened to that and talked about it. And I had a pretty similar take to that where I was like, I get this was a neat listen. It's very engaging piece of artwork. If you're willing to sit down and actually like put focus on it, I probably won't ever listen to it again. Like, I appreciate it for what it is. But when it comes to music, it's really just not what I'm looking for.
For sure.
It's not enjoyable, which it doesn't mean it's bad. It's just like, you know, sometimes I'd rather just jam out to Godsmack or Linkin Park or something, right? Like, you know, music can be active, but a lot of the times it's passive because I'm listening to music at work while I'm working and I want something that is just fun in the background.
Yeah. Speaking of, I've also been listening to a lot of Collision Course recently. The Linkin Park Jay-Z collab album from like 2005.
Oh, hell yeah.
Which that shit fucking slaps. I was never, I'd listened to it before, but I was never super into it. But I was listening to Reanimation, and then I was like, why isn't, I thought that the Jay-Z Numb remix was on there, but apparently it's on a different album, which I wasn't fully aware of, I guess. But anyway, I've been listening to that. And when it comes to music that is fun, that's some fun fucking music.
I listened to The Hunting Party yesterday. That Linkin Park album that people kind of forget exists. That's a pretty good album. The mixing on that is weird, though.
I thought most fans liked that album a lot.
It didn't... I don't think it was very commercially successful. I don't know if people really went out and bought it.
Interesting. My impression of it was that... because it's the one right after Thousand Sun. I guess Living Things.
After Living Things.
Yeah, but my impression of it was that a lot of people thought of it as a return to form in terms of like getting like being more back to like a lot of their roots in like nu metal and rock after, you know,
it's definitely a rock record. I wouldn't say it sounds like their early stuff, but
right,
it's fun. I enjoyed listening to it. It had been a while.
I hesitate to call Living Things and A Thousand Suns experimental, but they were definitely a significant departure. And I remember the response to there being a lot of backlash to those two albums at the time.
Yeah.
And that people were more into Hunting Party, which I don't know. To me, that's fucking insane. Well, not that people like Hunting Party, but it's fucking insane that people, you know, don't like Thousand Suns, the best Linkin Park album.
It's definitely up there. It's funny, when I listen to Linkin Park now, I typically am listening to the back half of their catalog.
Yeah.
I still like their front half, but there's something about Thousand Sun, Living Things, and then One More Light that I go back to a lot more now.
Yeah, for me, it's mostly A Thousand Suns and a little bit of Hybrid Theory and Meteora. I'm not a One More Light enjoyer, unfortunately. Just that is definitely an album that is like not for me.
Sure,
I just find it. It's kind of hard to talk about that album in some ways, but I find it to be very corny. But that's my Linkin Park take.
That's kind of a bad take, but we're at 17 minutes. Emily, you watched some Riverdale.
I did. I watched several episodes of Riverdale. John, you are not caught up. You're two episodes behind, right?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. Well, episode 14 is pretty wild, so I hope that you catch up by next week, because
I'll get to them like sometime early this week, hopefully.
Yeah. Because I didn't watch 15. And I'll watch 16 after it comes out next week. So we'll be caught up then. But, oh man, Riverdale continues to be the dumbest show in the world.
Yes.
Oh, God.
I love that they have gone this, that they went this step further in, and this was a few episodes ago at this point.
Yes.
And had, you know, in keeping with the main cast playing their parents.
Oh, that had, was cute. I liked
Hiram play his father. Yeah, I thought that was fun. I thought that episode was like kind of weak, but I enjoyed
it. I thought the episode was super corny, but I thought it was at least interesting to get some like background on Hiram as a character, even though like, I don't know, I don't like the attempt, or I don't like anything that possibly attempts to set up Hiram as like a sympathetic character, because like, God, I just don't care. Like he's just like a dickhead mobster dad. Like I don't need to
I find the Jughead voiceover at the beginning of that episode to be really funny.
Yeah.
Where he compares him to like Tony Soprano and what's his name? The guy from The Godfather and the guy from Scarface. And it's like the implication that Hiram Lodge has the ethos of any of those characters is just fucking hilarious on its face.
Yeah.
Hiram Lodge is a corny villain. And he plays that role. In that role, he's fantastic.
Yeah.
I think the...
he's perfect as, like, the corny villain of this show. Like, because he, like, really relishes in being the big bad of this show.
Yeah, and he's... And the actor who plays him, I don't remember his name, is fantastic.
I don't either. I know that he's married to Kelly Ripa, but that's all I know.
Hmm.
I only know that because my mom likes, liked Regis and Kelly, the...
Huh.
Like, daytime tea show.
Yeah. I had no idea.
Yeah.
But, I mean...
Yeah, he's married to Kelly Ripa. That's all I know. Because, like, my mom and sister know I watch Riverdale, and they happen to, like, hear about Kelly Ripa's husband being in Riverdale, so they, like, brought it up one time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Earlier, the other stuff while I was catching up on episodes, Gwen came in and saw Veronica with that like I don't even, like, the crystal or whatever, her, like, uncut gems crystal.
Yeah, the uncut gem stuff, yeah.
And all Gwyn saw was, like, her with this big crystal, and they were like, oh, is she gonna, like, summon the devil with it? Which, like, you know, given Riverdale is not that far off, but I did have to remind them that Veronica's doing an uncut gems this yes. season. Also,
I'm glad that
a little bit of Wolf of Wall Street now, I guess, they're actually attempting yeah. to do that.
Yeah, I'm so glad they went back to the uncut gems thing, because they did that bit early on in this season, and I thought it was just gone.
I really thought that they were going to leave it at, like, the one bit that she did, but no, this is continuing, no. I guess.
They pretty much just did the whole plot of uncut gems in, like, a 20-minute side plot.
Yeah.
Which is, like, come on, man.
Without it's killing funny. Her off.
Yeah. I mean, that is the great thing about Riverdale, is that it just, like, it aspires so much to be way better works of art, and along the way is somehow a masterpiece in its own right.
I know that it's sort of a rule that you're not supposed to, like, remind the audience of work that is better than your own, but Riverdale does not care about that, and unabashedly nope. just continues to, continues,
and that's part of what makes it great.
And I really do love that. I don't remember what episode this was in, but did you see the part where Kevin sings a song from Jesus Christ Superstar?
No.
That might be in an episode that you didn't see.
That sounds fantastic.
It's a lot. I have a lot of angry feelings about the way that they're doing Kevin's character, and that just continues my feelings about Kevin throughout this entire show, because...
Oh, you don't like that they put him in a cult again?
I really feel like, at this point, the way... Like, the disservice they have done to Kevin's character actually is homophobic now. Like, I don't... Yeah. Like, I know that Roberto Guerra-Sacasa is a gay man, but I don't care. Like, the fact that all they can do is, like... Kevin is cruising. Kevin is in a cult. Like, these are the only plots that we can give this character. And, like, he's yeah. our only, like, he's our only main gay male character. Like, we've got Fangs, and Fangs is, I guess, sleeping with Moose now. Like,
yeah.
because that's just, that's a thing that we need. Because
there's
to
three
do.
Gay people in Riverdale, and they always have to be in a love
there's
triangle.
There's three gay men in Riverdale, and they all have to be yeah. sleeping together at all times. Yes.
It is especially shitty given that, like, this show has kind of, like, done lesbian characters pretty well. Like not, yeah. I mean, it's a fucking CW show, but, like, it just cannot figure out what to do with its, you know,
it has,
gay men.
It has never, Riverdale has never known what to do with Kevin, and it's so frustrating. Like, yeah. it should not be this hard.
Yeah. I mean, the first cult thing was, like, initially, I thought it was fine because, like there in season three, he did genuinely feel abandoned by his friends.
Yeah, like,
and I think that there's something there, but it just yeah. went off the rails so fucking quickly in terms of just, like, the extremity of it, and then to just go back to that well in this season is frustrating.
Also, like, I don't understand this, like, Blossom cult thing that's going on, because I thought that it seemed like Penelope was doing this because she's, like, creating a cult to Jason or whatever, but then, like, in it's in episode 14, so we haven't seen this, but, like, at one point someone makes a crack about, like, Cheryl, like, trying to sacrifice people to gods or whatever, and she says goddesses, so, like, I don't know what they are doing with this, yeah. And I also feel, again, like, very weird about this show's one lesbian character being involved yeah. with a religious cult after she had a whole plot line about being in conversion therapy.
I think we talked about this before, but Cheryl and Tony have gotten done so dirty.
It's really awful. Tony, I feel like I mean, I know that it's probably because, like, she's off, like, probably having her IRL baby, but like Toni has not been in any of the episodes I watched catching up on, like past the break in the season. So I guess like she'll come back at some point, but like she wasn't in any of the episodes that, that I watched today.
Interesting, because yeah, I didn't realize that she still wasn't in it. That sucks. And my read on the like new cult was that it was a grift, that it was just like Penelope and Cheryl just like, oh, we're trying to make money.
Yeah, I don't know, because it kind of goes back and forth between seeming like, yeah, they know it's a grift, and also maybe they also believe in it. I don't know.
Yeah. The thing that salvaged the season 3 cult was that it was, like, ridiculous
in
some ways and funny. But when they tried to do that series, when they tried to play even that, even back then when they tried to play that straight, it was rough.
Yeah.
But, well, that's the Riverdale update, I guess. I guess we'll do another one next week.
You'll get to it, but Jughead's in Alcoholics Anonymous now.
Man. That seems like, I was so excited about the Bugmen thing.
Pour one out for Jughead.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, like, I mean, there's like, I don't know, there's a whole bunch of dumb shit. Riverdale wants to have its cake and eat it too with cryptids. It wants to like, it wants to be like, oh, cryptids are real, but are they? But they're real, but are they? Like,
yeah, I mean, it's like the season 3 thing of like, oh, there's magic happening.
These babies are floating in the air.
Yeah. Yes. And just like walk it back, like basically set it up in the first episode and then walk it back for the rest of the season.
I'm just waiting for Predator to show up in this show.
That would be sick. Let's
fucking go, dude. I'd be down. I'd be fucking down.
Yeah, that sounds great. Oh, John,
no. I feel like my last thing I'm going to say, sorry, I want to get to comics.
Yeah.
But I feel like we're getting close to the point where like there have been enough seasons and it's time for this cult to just be the one that causes Afterlife with Archie to be the next season.
Oh, also there's a dog fighting ring now.
Epic. Simply epic.
You also saw Shang-Chi and
yeah, that movie's fucking blows. I'm glad Alex isn't here. That movie is not good.
If I can attempt to see it next week, maybe we can have like a discussion with Alex.
I guess, except for the fact that it's a Marvel movie, so it's literally left my brain already.
That's fair.
But yeah, we should talk about some.
I want to talk about a couple of weeks ago. The Slaughter to Avail album, yes. Stolem, came out. I had opinions. I had Alex remove some of them because they weren't well informed, and I was unable to talk well that night. I ended up buying the album. I actually really enjoy it. I listen to it a lot now. So I want to say that this album's actually really good. You got to chop out song number 7 and then it doesn't lose its momentum because fucking, I think Bratva's right after that one. And that song, you know, it's I Killed a Man and then Bratva, and those songs like fucking drive. Those are great. And so I've really been enjoying this album. Fucking deathcore meets new metal. It's fun. I'm trying to do a cover of Demolisher. Russian's really hard to pronounce. And that's about it. But yeah. I wanted to retract previous statements. I've changed my mind.
I'm happy for you,
Chad. You have learned and grown, and I'm proud of you. We should talk about comic.
We have a lot of them.
We have a lot. Yeah, it was not like the biggest week ever, but a lot of stuff that I actually wanted to read.
Yeah, it's fucked up.
Yeah, you hate to you honestly hate to see it. Let's talk about Swamp Thing number 7.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about Swamp Thing, because I think we all exhibited some hesitancy about the Suicide Squad showing up in our Swamp
Thing. I mean, it's mostly just because they've been showing up in fucking everything, as evidenced by the fact that they have their own annual right now.
Yes. Well, I hope you didn't read that.
I actually did, but it sucks, so...
Did not read that.
I mean, yeah, like, we don't have to talk about it, because I kind of, after I finished it, I realized, no one else has read this.
Fortunately, I feel that the Swamp Thing did not muck up this issue, or that the Suicide Squad did not muck up this issue of Swamp Thing very much.
I don't think so either.
And instead, what we got is a very, like... And this is kind of what this run has been. It's very evocative of the Alan Moore run on Swamp Thing in terms of, like, you know, it's very much about, you know, him getting in touch with the earth and the, you know, having revelations about his previous life and all that good stuff. And I thought that the character arc here, like with all of the flashbacks where he goes, where he's just seeing, and this is something that the last two issues, I think the last two have had as well, is him, you know, reliving his past before he became the Swamp Thing and how he basically betrayed his family and the place where he's from in the name of progress. And by progress, of course, I mean selling his land to a multinational corporation. And now he's returned in a stroke of dramatic irony as the defender of the land. And in this case, defending it from the Suicide Squad, not necessarily the multinational. But I assume that's coming. And I think that it is really well executed. Just like his whole story, and I feel his whole story from, you know, his father trying to reason with him about their heritage, and
that
then
part was really sad.
It's really sad because the whole time, you know, like yeah, obviously you're just being a fucking useful idiot for global capital, and that's it. And your dad and your brother are telling you like it is, which is that they only care about this as a profit seeking method. They're not, your heritage is far more important than that. And the kind of progress that they're going to bring is going to do more harm than good. And that shit is all pulled off, I think, really, really well, in terms of like both his internal conflict and also the much broader ramifications. I really like this issue. I thought it was excellent.
I like this issue fine. There are times where I wish this wasn't a superhero comic.
Yeah.
Because the superhero stuff gets in the way. Like, we're gearing up for a kaiju-sized fight. He's going to go up against that toxic guy. And that's dumb. It totally does not fit everything else that is going on in this issue or the previous issues. I don't like the Suicide Squad in this.
See,
pretty much at all.
I thought they were fine.
I kind of disagree with you on that point because I think that thematically, I think him going up against Chemo is kind of perfect. Like, yeah, I prefer this
thematically
comic.
It works, but like from an artistic standpoint, like you have this neon green blob guy who looks like he belongs in a totally different comic book just from his character design and coloring.
I don't think that's true. Like he's
yeah,
he's
I don't think he's that out of place.
Yeah, he's a literal manifestation. He's a literal manifestation of like Levi's internal conflict. Like that is such a classic storytelling trope.
I'm not saying that's not true. I just don't like his design. I don't think it fits. It feels like a fucking comic book character, and a lot of this issue does not feel like a comic or, you know, superhero thing. Like,
yeah,
sure.
I feel like there's tonal whiplash going on. The idea is good. The execution, and it's not. I don't think it's Ram V's fault. They're using a character that's probably been in other stuff before, and like that's what he looks like. But he strikes me as like very cartoony in a world that does not feel cartoony.
Yeah. No, that's fair. I mean, it definitely feels like an editorial, like something that's been passed down to Ram V from editorial.
Yeah.
Like you gotta put the Suicide Squad in your Swamp Thing comic to, you know, tie into the movie and Swamp Thing, you know. Despite having a really hardcore group of fans, which me, traditionally is not a book that sells very well. So maybe putting Suicide Squad on the cover will help it sell. I don't think that's true, but he's sort of working with the hand that he's dealt here. And I think that like the avenue he's come to work with the hand he's dealt is, you know, as good as it could be. Like, I do agree. I mean, I'd obviously prefer this story. Like, you know, I don't mind, like, the superhero fight that it's setting up in the next issue where, like, you know, Swamp Thing is going to fight this massive, like, literal personification of the destruction that is coming to his ancestral home in India. But it is fair to say that, like, Chemo in particular feels out of place. But I really dug this. I think it's a good. I mean, this book has been good. I mean, pretty much.
It's been consistently good.
It's I'm. It's not like new ground that we're treading. But I like this a lot.
Yeah, for the record, I like it. I just have some minor quibbles with it.
Yeah,
but on the whole, like it's still been worth reading. It's a very solid comic, and it's doing what it wants to do, I think, pretty well.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. We've got a whole lot of other stuff to cover, so we should maybe get on to it. I feel like one of the big headliners this week was the second issue of The Me You Love in the Dark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because this is a first issue that we were all very high on, for good reason. And I think the second issue, I think I'm even higher on the second issue than I was on the first. It sort of, the first issue set itself up as kind of a horror comic where there's a ghost living in the house with this artist, and set up the cliffhangers like, you know, oh, she's talking to the ghost, and this issue is, you know, her actually having multiple full conversations with them.
It was cute. I liked it.
I like how it's skewing towards like an actual romance, which makes sense given the title of it.
Yes.
But her the way she's talking to the ghost and the way the ghost is talking back, like it almost feels flirtatious at times.
It's a spooky little romance. I like it.
And then you get a shot of him at the end and he's like got this like eldritch shit going on in the background. And I'm just like, yeah, it's great. I dig this so hard.
Yeah. He is a really horrific figure. When you see him at the end, his like he's got like a normal human body, just like maybe a little like taller, but sprouting out from his head is like a half a dozen more heads with big eyes and sharp teeth,
yeah,
and a really disgusting tongue. And I just gotta give massive props to Jorge Corona, mm-hmm, or Coronia, I think, on that art. It is genuinely like really fucking creepy. In a book that otherwise is not creepy at all, I think Chad hit the nail on the head in terms of describing their relationship, which is very flirtatious. She's just like, you know, they're like sort of are immediately hitting it off, talking about her art, and, you know, interacting with each other. It's very fun to read.
Yeah. It's the only thing that is a little struck me as weird is, when like the ghost walks her to her bedroom and she doesn't like immediately leave, because like fuck that, I feel like fight or flight would have kicked in for most people, and the plot was like, yeah, but she can't leave, so she just doesn't. But yeah, then it goes on, and I like where it goes. I had that was like the one kind of turning point moment in this comic where I was like, it kind of lost me, then you got me back by the end.
Yeah.
I feel like she's very, I feel like it's one of those things where she's intrigued by it. And I have a sort of vague recollection of the previous issue ending, like with her, you know, having some drinks. So maybe a little bit of that. But also she had the sort of like storm out moment at the end of the last issue, and then came back.
So, that's true.
I felt like that was fine. I love the moment when she finishes her painting and it's like supposed to be a portrait of like how she envisions him,
mm-hmm,
and he's just like, oh, that's, I love it, thank you. It's very, it's good,
it's cute.
I had a really good time with this. Similarly had a really good time with Mamo number 3.
Which is a book that has really been
a surprise hit for me. I think I said this the last issue, but usually this is not my shit. But in this case, I really love this issue. I am really fucking digging
it's
this book.
It's really good.
Yeah.
Like the art is just so like, I just really like this style, really lends itself to this sort of story. And like, I don't know, like the world building is so like subtle and I just like it so much.
It feels like such a massive world with so
many
like interesting things going on in it. And every issue, like this issue, a big part of this issue, because they're, you know, obviously going around trying to collect all the bone, all of Mamo's bones. And a big part of this issue is, you know, the characters going and seeking out the wisdom of the birds. And it turns out the birds, like, speak English, and Joanna has like a relationship with one of them in terms of like being one of her oldest friends.
Mm-hmm.
That scene was great.
It's
so,
so
dude, good.
The moment when that bird manifests into like an actual, like, I don't know, probably like 3 or 4 foot tall, like sort of humanoid creature that just looks like a guy in a a guy in a cool hat with a cool trench coat. Yeah,
it's really dope.
I fucking loved that. That is like so stylish too. It's so cool. The book has a lot of style. I mean, it really like it. The visuals are definitely, you know, it's definitely like a boombox art style. But the characters are so expressive, which is great. And I don't know. I love the way that magic works in this. I love that it's like one of those books where like it's like wholesome heavy square quotes, wholesome content. But like, there's actually like conflict and tension between the characters and with what's going on. I'm really, really enjoying it. Like it always just feels like every issue feels like there's like this sort of dark undercurrent to it that is never like at the full, never like fully brought into focus, but it's like, there's always like this sense of danger and menace to what they're doing. Even if it never is like fully the focus of the story, which I really enjoy, like that tonal balance that it's striking.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the fantasy stuff in there too. There's, like you said, there's a lot of really good world building. I like the rules of the magic and how they're kind of simple but also kind of complex.
Yes.
And the dynamic between the two characters, where one's a witch and knows stuff, but then the other one knows the town and then also has this relationship with the birds. So, like, she really got to like take charge and really prove herself in this dynamic that it has to be them that's going to solve this.
Mm-hmm.
That was a really good, you know, just a good scene to really like point that out, that it's not like a Harry Potter thing where it's like, oh, teach me about magic and I'll learn with the viewer. You know, it's like, no, I know stuff too.
Yeah.
We're in this together and it's going to take both of us or the mystery's not going to get solved. And I don't know if it needed to do that, but I'm glad it did. I think it added a lot of dynamic to the lead characters.
I agree.
Yeah, definitely. I love the aspect of like, you know, people just don't trust the witch because she's a witch and she's out of touch with, you know, the sort of day-to-day reality. And that's sort of where Joanna comes in, as almost like an interpreter in terms of being able to talk to people, and you know, engage with her surroundings and the way that they're able to engage with their surroundings in different ways because of what they know and don't know. It's good stuff. I'm really liking this. This is, yeah, like I said, a real, real sleeper hit for me.
And also the way that they hold hands.
Yep. That doesn't, yeah.
It's cute.
Doesn't surprise me that was probably your favorite part of the issue.
Yeah.
Emily's got a brand.
Yep.
Yeah.
What'd you guys think of The Nice House on the Lake, number 4?
I'm still vibing with this.
Yeah, I was a little worried with the, like, trajectory of this story, but I feel like issue 4 has like got me back up, because I feel like it started off really strong and then I started to get a little worried, but now like I'm back up to excited about it. We got some new rules for the world.
Yeah, it's sort of tough because it sort of feels like not a lot happens plot wise like issue to issue.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we see them in this house obviously, and they're like, you know, coping with the world having collapsed.
Yeah.
And we know that at some point, it seems like at some point they get, based on the like little snippets that we get at the beginning from the POV characters, that at some point they move on from the house or get away from it in some way.
Well, they have like some of the surrounding area that they've been able to explore.
Right. It just feels like we're not quite getting, like, not a whole lot is happening in terms of progressing it there. That being said, I'm having difficulty actually like leveraging that critique in the way that I normally would, given that I think that these characters are so compelling and the ways that they are all coping with it differently. Mm-hmm. Is really, I don't know, like, I don't know if fun is the right word for it, considering that one of the characters is very clearly trying to just fucking kill herself.
Yeah.
in this,
man,
issue.
When that guy brings her a razor, because like Walter wouldn't give her one, so he gives her one, and yeah. I was like, fuck, holy shit, this is, where is this going? I was like,
wait, did you not realize that that's what she wanted?
Oh yeah, I'm not dumb, but like, just the fact that it played out that way entirely, like
where it's not like she just literally can't kill herself because they can't die.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is definitely a pretty sizable revelation.
Yeah, I was not expecting them not being able to die. I don't, you know, it seems like it fits with everything, but just for whatever reason, that was not what I anticipated for this story.
Yeah. Well, there's part of me that's a little worried it's going the lost route of like, oh, they were already dead and now they're living in purgatory.
Oh, that would be super upsetting.
I certainly hope not. And I obviously am not going to evaluate the comic based on an ending that obviously hasn't happened yet. What's here is really good. I really love just how many little details work their way into the art as well.
Yeah.
Alvaro Martinez Bueno is the artist on this book. And just like the double page bar scene at the beginning,
yes,
similar to the one in the first issue, just has so much detail and so much vibrancy.
So I love good.
That. I love all the different shots that we get of the house that are just like, it's just amazing how much, like, just like how much work must have gone into some of these panels in terms of like, you know, you see the kitchen and like everything is drawn on there. Like you get like the them cooking and, you know, you get the sense that it's a place that people are living, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's like bowls and stuff left out and coffee mugs left out. It's just,
it's a fucking mess because they don't care anymore, right? Like you get the sense that it's lived in, but also all of these characters don't have it in them to like keep the place clean right now.
Yeah.
It's just, definitely.
They're so emotionally checked out.
Yeah. No, it's really good.
We're almost at 50 minutes. What do we want to hit next?
Can I just very quickly say that I continue to like Crush and Lobo?
Yes.
Right now, I won't belabor the point, but the current plot line is that Lobo tricked his daughter into like taking his place in prison where he was, and so now she has teamed up with like the person who runs the prison to go out and hunt Lobo and bring him back so that he actually will be in the prison. But if she doesn't, she has a thing that's gonna like totally disintegrate her body within like 2 days.
Nice. I hope she succeeds.
I hope she doesn't die because I like her. And she has a she has a girlfriend that she's a little bit on the outs with on Earth that I want her to make up with because she needs to realize the importance of showing up for important family dinners.
Yeah. I don't know. I remember that one of those early issues where she goes to the birthday party. Like, this is fucking stupid. And I'm like, yeah, facts. You're right about that.
Okay, but
I wouldn't put up with that shit either.
Just because she doesn't like the birthday party doesn't mean it's not important to her girlfriend. They should have maybe talked about it.
Yeah.
That sounds like a bad Taylor Swift song. Hey, if we're gonna knock stuff out quickly, yes. Batman Catwoman is still kind of dumb.
Yeah. I kind of like it. I mean, even if it's a little dumb.
I mean, the big emotional hook on this is like everyone's sad that angry that Selina Kyle killed the Joker. Like, I can't believe you killed the Joker. And the whole thing is just like, you know, Batman, we should kill the Joker. He's like, I'm Batman. I don't kill a Joker. Joker killing's bad. Like, well, he broke out of Arkham again and went on, you know, a murder spree. He's like, oh, I can't kill. And so Selina's like, fuck, I'm going to go do it. And they're like, I can't believe Mom would kill somebody.
Yeah.
It's really there's so many like fun things in this, and then like the core emotional thing it's hinging on is dumb as rocks.
Yeah.
Also, I love how the Christmas Carol is "Oh Come All Ye Faithful."
Okay, that actually was my least favorite part of the issue, was like the through line of "Come All Ye Faithful," like in the beginning with it being in the sex scene, and then like bringing it back at the end. Like,
it was
stupid.
So childish. I laughed. I was like, stupid. Ah, look at you doing. You think you're clever.
Stupid.
I continue to not read this. We should hit the number ones, both of which were from Dark Horse, and one of which is from
Papa
Comics Papa. Podcast favorite. Yeah, Jeff Lemire. Written and drawn by Jeff
I didn't
Lemire,
know he was drawing this one. I was pleasantly surprised when I started reading and saw his art.
I love it whenever he draws his own books. I feel like just his watercolors are phenomenal.
I love his style. It's just so, like, very specific and evocative. Yeah. And I'm interested in where this book is going. This was mostly just, like, set up, so, like, you know, not much really happened, but
yeah, I thought it was a solid first issue. I mean, it's
solid number one.
It's Yeah, definitely stuff, something, you know, I think most people have seen before. It's a guy who has basically lost his will to live, but is still enamored with, you know, being a productive worker and a valued member of society. So falls into a really shitty rhythm where he goes to work every day and does nothing enjoyable within his life, goes home and goes to bed, wakes up, goes to work, and just lives this monotonous, unfulfilling, awful life while grieving about his presumably dead daughter.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's nothing new. Lemire does it very well, though, and I think that, like, his art in particular goes a long way.
Yes.
In terms of just, like, showing this character's just abject misery and sadness. Just, like, him standing under the that panel of him standing under the shower, just with his head slanted, like, not even, like, washing himself, just, like, you know, almost, like, unable to move, almost, like, paralyzed by a situation is just so evocative and really, really kind of heartbreaking. And then, of course, it's, you know, there's more going on than we thought. His daughter is talking to him from, you know, beyond the grave or from somewhere in his mind. So there's a little more going on than just that. Remains to be seen where we're going with it. It's hard to, like, talk about that aspect of the book too much because this is very much just set up. But I liked it. I thought it was a solid first issue.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, it gave me Royal City vibes.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Definitely. Cool. Last Flight Out, the other Dark Horse number one this week.
Kind of sucked.
Yeah?
Yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't, like...
I didn't care for it.
I didn't, like, dislike it. I wasn't, like, super strong on it, but I also didn't, like, think it was bad. I thought it was just sort of... It felt a little, like... Some of it was a little typical, like, oh, he was so absorbed in his work, and now he has to go save his daughter, like...
Yeah, it's not...
It felt a little cliche, but, like, I thought it was all right.
Yeah, I don't think any of it is bad, per se. It's just really fucking bland.
Yeah, I don't feel anything, like, new or interesting out of this concept.
Yeah, and it's not even necessary. It's not even just that, but also just, like yeah, like, obviously this is fucking tried and true territory. But there are plenty of books that are tried and true territory that can still be good.
Yeah.
And the characters here are just, like, feel, like, so empty. Like, they literally just feel like walking TV tropes fucking entries.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is can be frustrating to read. Just, I don't know. This is one of those that I finish it and I'm like, yeah, they're angling for a Netflix deal on that one for sure. For sure. But I didn't hate it.
Yeah, I can, I didn't think of it, but I absolutely see, like, this feels like something that would be made into a Netflix show.
Yeah. It's fine. I don't know if, like, I don't know if I care enough to even bother reading the next issue, though, to be honest. Like, especially if it comes out in a week where there's, like, you know,
yeah,
a dozen or so comics I want to read, like, I'll skip this, skip the second issue of this.
Is anyone still reading Six Sidekicks?
No.
I think everyone but me is reading.
Yeah, I mean, I read it. I'm liking it still. I wasn't sure for a little bit, but I'm back, like, pretty high on Six Sidekicks. I really like the girl that they have introduced into the sidekick group, who's the little, like, little fighty girl, and who beat up all the bikers, and now she has, like, a little biker vest. I don't really care that much about, like, the actual, like, I don't care about the mystery necessarily, but I like the dynamic of, like, these, like, all these sidekick characters and all their baggage with this, like, one asshole actor man. So, yeah, I'm here for it. I also like the art style. It's kind of weird, but I used to have, like, a friend who did a similar style as this, where it was, like, sort of, like, not as much focused on drawing all of the lines of a thing that is happening. And I don't know. I'm enjoying this comic. I'm interested to see how all of this will wrap up, because it's like a mini, right? Like, we're not...
I hope so.
Six issues.
Yeah, I was gonna say, if it's not six issues, I don't... It feels appropriate for it to be six issues, but...
Six issues, one for each sidekick.
Yeah.
I don't think that's actually the structure of the book.
But. Well, no, like, they're not separated like that, but I think it is, you know, like, it makes sense to have six issues for six sidekicks of Trigger Keaton. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, yeah, definitely. Well, we're almost at an hour, so I guess we can probably just hit Excellence number 11 and get out of here, which this is Excellence kind of, you know, in that Snot Girl mythos of, you know, maybe we'll get two issues a year if we're fucking lucky. And predictably, those issues we get will be very good. But this is the first issue, I think, in, I don't know, it feels like 6 months or so, maybe longer now. I mean, I think the last issue of this might actually have come out last year. But
I'm not reading this. I know that I need to, but it's because I need to catch up on 11 issues.
You really should.
I know I'll like it. I just forgot about it. And then, like, I just didn't have enough time to catch up on all of it before the show.
Yeah. I would love to, at some point, just sit down and read this all the way through again, because it is definitely one of those things where there is so much mythology backing a lot of this stuff up that, you know, it's easy to lose track of when there's long gaps between issues. And that this issue, at least for me, definitely suffered from some of that, because I didn't exactly remember where the plot was where exactly we were in terms of the events that are unfolding. Mm-hmm. But I thought that, you know, it was a solid issue. I really like the main character, you know, his interactions with this woman who turns out to be his sister, and her sort of giving her it's a decent amount of exposition, but her basically just giving him a lot of backstory that sheds a lot of light on how things got to be the way they are. but in a way that, you know, it never feels like boring. I never found myself like disengaged from this issue. What did you think, Chad?
It's good. I ended up reading the issue 10 as well with it. Cause I had forgotten to do that and has just been sitting in my downloads folder for like a year. issue 10 was really good. I was obviously had to remember plot stuff or just go along with the ride, but there's a lot of really cool action, really cool reveals and whatnot in there, and the power dynamics of the world being totally different than kind of what was presented in the first arc was fun. And then reading the letters there where people were kind of mad about issue 8 for some of like the white supremacy stuff and like the Trump-like character. Evidently that was a big to-do for readers who are just like, what do you mean this is an allegory?
Wait, really? I didn't read the letters. I read like the bit at the beginning of the letters for issue 11 where they were like, yeah, our careers are skyrocketing. And actually, like, major congrats to both Carrie Rudolph and I forget the writer's name, Brandon Thomas, who are now, you know, working on, you know, big two comics. It feels earned. I hope those are as good as this, but I read that part, but I did not read that there was a controversy about this book being about white supremacy.
Yeah, evidently.
It's so weird.
Sharpest crayons in the
I'm so shocked that you can get to issue 8 of a comic in which black people use the black magic users are forced to use their magic to protect rich white people by a ruling cast of white. Like, how do you get there and not that's just wild to me. That's like so clearly like the allegory for this. Like, and it is an effective one. I think it's an effective one. I mean, the fucking villain is literally a guy in a Klansman outfit. Like,
yeah.
I'm a little surprised that it was not immediately clear to people that what was going on here.
Issue 11 is good. I think the problem I've had with this comic since the beginning is the way it handles information can be kind of clunky and hard to follow. Mm-hmm. So I definitely had parts where I was sort of lost on exactly what was going on with this one. And I was like, I kind of wish someone would just, no bullshit, like, this is what is happening. You know, just vomited at me so we can pull the Band-Aid off. Because some of the panel layouts and the way things were going back and forth between multiple characters and then, like, the font colors kept changing. It was just kind of visually overwhelming, and it got a little muddled for me.
Sure. No, that is definitely fair. Like, I really dig, like, the art in this book, but it always feels like there is a lot going on every page, and in some of these, like, exposition-heavy pages, it feels like maybe It would help if that wasn't so much the case.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, it's tough because like a lot of this issue is like, you know, his sister taking him around what is basically the prison that she's living in, doing sort of mundane tasks. And I really liked that aspect of it, of like, she is like beyond the point of caring about if people know that she has magic, that she's, you know, is a witch or not. And I liked that aspect of it, but it definitely did make it a little, it did feel a little odd that it kept cutting between different things. And it wasn't always clear exactly what was happening. But I don't know. I still dig it. I think it's really good. And it feels like, based on, you know, some, like, what happens at the end of this issue, that it sort of seems like we're headed towards the end. Which is good, because not everything needs to last forever.
Yeah.
But I suppose we can go ahead and wrap it up there. We will, of course, be back next week with more of the comics podcast. With, you know, Alex will be back. We'll have, hopefully, a full crew. Probably a full crew. You can find us online on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, all that good stuff. We're at the Comics Podcast on all those places. Chad, where can people find you on the internet?
People can find me, I'm on Twitter at InonumBand, InOnum. You can find my short stories at InonumWordPress.com. My music is at InonumBandCamp.com. It all kind of sucks, but I'll have a new EP out sometime later this year that will be better. I got a couple of books on Amazon, The Ninth Life, Dreamscape, and Toyland. And then if you want to buy my video game on Steam, that's The Land of Glass.
Awesome. Emily, where can...
They can find me on Twitter at mpandanata or at the podcast Imagine Me in Utena at UtenaCast on Twitter, or the Fresh Podcast Market, Fresh Pod Market on Twitter. I also... produce Puella Magi, Modica Magicast, Big Steppy, Backseat Drawing, and now, as of this week, I'm producing the Glee Recap and Review podcast, Loser Like Me. So I have another podcast in my stable.
Oh. The Emily podcasting empire continues to
expand. I continue to grow my empire, yes.
You can find me at Mountain Dew Liker on Twitter. You can find Alex at AlexAnzia. His words occasionally at cgmag.com. That'll do it for us this week. Thank you all for listening, and we will talk to you again in 7 days' time. Take care, everybody.
Bye.
Bye, everyone.